Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Truman Capote waited anxiously for their deaths, but appeal after appeal stayed their hangings for 5 years. Still, Capote refused to publish a word until Perry Smith and Dick Hickok were in the ground. Maybe he feared them. Maybe the point of his, and the world's first, nonfiction novel was that crime leads to punishment, and the punishment, in this case, was the worst Kansas could mete out. The crime itself was a terrible thing. Four members of one family tied up and killed, each with a single shotgun blast to their brains, and all for about $40 or $50. The burning question was why? Why did two petty criminals drive deep into the rural western Kansas farmland to murder a man whose heart's desire was growing wheat? Why did they have to kill his wife and two teenage children as well? What did the family have that these two punks wanted? What did they ever do to deserve this kind of death? It was a deeply upsetting, soul-shaking crime, especially if you lived in their small hometown of Holcomb, Kansas, in the late fall of 1959. But it was not so much the crime of the century until the two men who committed it died, and Capote's fact-based retelling of it took hold of the American imagination, first as a serialized narrative in The New Yorker in 1965, and then as a book in 1966. And, you probably know, in the American classroom, because In Cold Blood was the first of its kind, a true crime story written with an immersive storytelling style that humanized the killers as well as the victims, all while forging a foreboding and forbidding tale that illuminated the criminal depravity that lives among us every day. In Cold Blood has sold millions of copies, been made into multiple movies, and is the subject of more than a few documentaries. It even has the distinction of having been banned for its gory content. Truman Capote, who was already a famous author when he tackled the Clutter story, was launched into another stratosphere altogether. Here's Johnny Carson introducing him on Carson's old late-night talk show.
My next guest I consider a very good friend of mine and is the author of novels, short stories, and plays. He's certainly taking his place on the front rank of American letters. He's a gentleman who a long time ago said, "I'm as tall as a shotgun and just as noisy." Would you welcome Truman Capote?
When Capote talked about his work on In Cold Blood, he, in that childlike voice of his, called it
an experiment in journalism. You see, people are always with me making this distinction between subject matter and style. What they don't understand is that what is important to me is literary experiments in style. And to me, Breakfast at Tiffany's or Other Voices, Other Rooms, which is my first novel, or In Cold Blood, are really one and all the same thing, because the serious part is the experiment in literary style.
However Capote saw his work, In Cold Blood stood apart. It's talked about in every university in the land, in some class, somewhere, I am sure, every day. And it never fails to make the lists of America's best novels. In 2017, it was named Publisher Weekly's number one true crime book. But this isn't English class. This is a podcast about crime, and Capote's version, the version in which he maintained, quote, every word is true, unquote, may not be the whole story after all. Every word might, so sorry Truman, not be true. That's because some new evidence has popped up that questions a few of the book's assumptions. But don't get carried away. It's not evidence, you know? DNA saying they got the wrong guys. No, it's that the story Capote told may have been the one the Kansas Bureau of Investigation wanted told, was easiest to tell, spared some people embarrassment or worse, or simply fit better into the format Truman wanted to pioneer. To be sure, the evidence still implicates Smith and Hickok as the men who killed the Clutters. But the recent appearance of the long-stored notes of one of the lead investigators in the case has prompted a lot of what Capote wrote to be questioned, and some of the why of what Smith and Hickok did is under equal scrutiny. Before I get all carried away with what Truman may have glossed over, let's get to the story he did tell about the crime itself. In the very early morning hours of November 15th, 1959, in a large house on a massive wheat farm, teetotaling, straight-laced farmer and farm activist Herb Clutter lived with his dangerously depressed wife Bonnie and his two youngest children, Nancy, the vivacious all-American diary-keeping, pie-making 16-year-old who knew everybody and helped everybody, and Kenyon, 15, who was her typically taciturn teenage brother. That's when Perry Smith, 31, and Dick Hickok, 28, quietly entered and, using a layout of the house drawn up by an outsider, searched for a safe loaded with cash, but couldn't find it. That's when they awakened Herb, 48, who was sleeping in the downstairs primary bedroom by himself, and demanded he take them to the safe. Herb, disoriented and without his glasses to help him see who was asking, said he had no safe. The men told Herb, who everyone in town knew wrote checks for everything including haircuts, they wanted the $10,000 they'd been told was in this safe. By the by, that's just over $100,000 in today's money. Herb said he never kept that kind of money around and told them to take anything they wanted to, but please, just do so and leave. A small note here. You gotta remember that what happened inside that house was derived from the confessions of the two perpetrators, and even they differ a bit. No one survived the attack, so there is no one to correct them. But this is the probable scenario. When the safe talk went south, Herb was asked to wake up his wife so that she might help them find some valuables. She was sleeping downstairs in a bedroom that one of her older daughters had previously occupied. Bonnie had, for a very long time, been almost confined to that room, her choice, thus all but abandoning her family, saddled as she was by mental illness, as well as by the narcotics and barbiturates she was prescribed for what was described as a kind of extended postpartum depression. Nancy, in a weekly maid, did all the cooking and cleaning and socializing necessary to keep the family in the city's good stead. but it did not make for a fun family dynamic that many who didn't know them well assumed the Clutters enjoyed. Anyway, after Bonnie was summoned, so were Nancy and Kenyon. It's believed that Nancy had previously heard the commotion downstairs because, and this is kind of sweet and horrible at the same time, a gold watch, the only thing she had of any real value, was found hidden in the toe of an old shoe in her closet. Apparently, she had had just enough time to hide it. Hickok and Smith made the rounds of everyone's room. Smith said he kept moving Hickok out of Nancy's room because Hickok was known to assault young girls, and Smith wasn't having that. Hickok would later write a letter to a reporter saying he went to the Clutter house that night because he knew a teenage girl was there and had decided he'd rape her. Nancy was, in any case, not sexually assaulted when she was found in her bed, with the covers pulled up to her chin, shot in the head. Her mother was found similarly tucked in, similarly slain. Kenyon and Herb were, at some point, taken downstairs into the basement, and both men were tied with rope that the killers had brought with them. Both were shot in the head, though Herb's throat was apparently cut almost clean through before that happened. Herb also looked to have suffered some torture before his death. The coroner determined that they were all likely killed between 11 p.m. the night before and 2 a.m. that morning. The order of death, he felt sure, was Bonnie, Nancy, Kenyon, then Herb. It was supposed that Herb was forced to watch the others die in hopes that would encourage him to give up the safe's whereabouts more readily. But there had never been any safe to give up. The bodies of the Clutter family were not discovered until the following morning when two of Nancy's friends went to check on her. Sue Kidwell was supposed to see the Clutters that Sunday morning, and a 1993 public TV documentary called Holcomb, The Death of Innocence, Sue's mother Wilma remembered,
"My daughter was a best friend of Nancy Clutter, and the week before this happened, Susan stayed out there all weekend. They always stopped here and got her for Sunday school, because I didn't go to Sunday school then. And that morning, they didn't show up. And they went out there and they found the situation, which was pretty bad for everybody."
An understatement, I'm sure. Herb, in a strange coincidence, and after having put it off for years, had spent the afternoon of his death buying life insurance in the amount of $40,000 with the stipulation that if he died violently, the policy payout would be double. The check he wrote to cover that first premium was still in the pocket of his agent the next morning. The insurance company, however, still paid off the claim made by Herb's older daughters, who had not been aware that the policy had been bought. In many ways, part of the horror of the story was how totally normal the Clutters were, how ordinary, and how freaking remote. I mean, they lived miles from anything that could be called a real city. And yet, Herb Clutter was not some random wheat farmer. From Greg McAvoy's book, And Every Word Is True, quote, "Post-war agriculture in the plains was booming. In 1947, Kansas produced the largest wheat yield in the state's history, a miracle crop of nearly 287 million bushels. Larger operations like Clutter's 3,000-acre River Valley Farm boasted its best wheat yield ever," end quote. Herb was also one of the first wheat farmers to figure out how to diversify his crop plan while also arranging to lease the mineral rights on his land to a natural gas company in exchange for a share of their profits. His farm savvy earned him a New York Times story in its business section in 1954. By then, he had already founded the Kansas Association of Wheat Growers and had been appointed to the Federal Farm Credit Board by President Dwight Eisenhower. He was also on the USDA Grain Advisory Committee, the International Wheat Advisory Committee, and had started to do battle with the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson over ensuring price parity for American wheat farmers. Secretary Benson didn't like him, calling his subsidies idea socialism, among the uglier words you could sling in that decade. When Clutter was slain, a significant part of America took notice, a few elitists did so with relief. Still, most were, like the local police and the deeply affected town where this happened, mystified. Who would do these terrible killings? Investigators from the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, or KBI, were brought in immediately and were no more knowledgeable about who killed the Clutters or why. The only physical evidence left were two footprints on a piece of cardboard that was laid on the ground to make Herb's final nest more tolerable. The spent shotgun shells had been collected by the killers and, aside from Nancy's 18-year-old boyfriend, about whom Herb had wanted his daughter to be less enthused, there were no suspects. The boyfriend was cleared pretty quickly, and still, the KBI could find no motive for the gruesome murders. Unless you thought it was robbery. Hell, it was hardly a robbery. Only $40 to $50 had been taken from the house. Nobody travels across the state and commits multiple homicides for chump change. Investigators were getting nowhere. That is, until news about the story of the crime spread and a former state prison cellmate of Dick Hickox came forward. Floyd Wells said he had worked for the Clutters in the past and had told Dick about the rich farmer and his safe full of money. He had even drawn him a map of the house, telling him that the haul would be worth the trouble and it'd be a cinch to pull off. The rest, according to the official KBI report and Capote, was detective work with cops picking up random pieces of information here and there until December 30th, 1959, about 6 weeks after the killings. That's when Dick and Perry were arrested by some vigilante Las Vegas police officer who recognized their car from an all-points bulletin issued a few weeks earlier. Originally, the two men blamed each other for pulling the trigger, but that changed fast with Perry Smith confessing he'd done all the actual killing. He added that Dick had cried over not getting to put an official end to Herb. It really didn't matter who pulled the trigger, though. It's true in most states that you participate in a crime and you bear equal responsibility for any injury or death that ensues. The jury deliberated all of 40 minutes. Both got the death penalty. Perry was the one with the absolutely awful childhood. Still, he had an almost sweet side and walked with a limp he had acquired in a bad motorcycle accident. Dick was the one with a nice family, but was likely a psychopath, or had become one after an accident left his face badly scarred, his eyes a tad askew, and his heart unfindable. Both were hanged. That's the nutshell version. If you haven't, do read the book. It's riveting. But is it all true? It's a fact that Capote had incredible, unprecedented, and almost total access to the crime scene, the investigation, and the killers. Traveling to Holcomb immediately after the slayings, he brought along Harper Lee, his childhood friend who was about a year away from having her own book, To Kill a Mockingbird, published. Her well-bred southern charm, wit, and graciousness have been given most of the credit for the high-pitched voice and decidedly odd southerner-turned-Manhattanite gadfly being accepted even confided in, by those who lived in the outer reaches of the Midwest. Wilma Kidwell again.
He was a little short fellow, kind of dumpy fellow, and spoke rather oddly. But, you know, he was kind. He was a good person, so I took him as he was, and he was never offensive in his questions at all.
Wilma spoke to Capote for his book, so yeah, he did the work. Because of this, and because of his and Harper Lee's cultivation of a relationship with KBI agent Alvin Dewey, a relationship many found to be unethical on the part of Dewey, Capote swore early and often that he had the goods, journalistically at least. On the occasion of In Cold Blood being published, Capote told a Newsweek reporter that, quote, "It's a completely factual account and every word is true," end quote. He also told Newsweek, and this is for the English majors, the journalists and literature enthusiasts out there, quote, "I had this theory about reportage. I've always felt that if you brought the art of the novelist together with the techniques of journalism, fiction with the added knowledge that it was true, it would have the most depth and impact," end quote. He wasn't wrong. His details were astonishingly specific, and his conclusions equally so. He called it, quote-unquote, immaculately factual, though he still classified the book as a nonfiction novel, which should be an oxymoron because novel means fiction. Anyway, in his mind and in the literary world that embraced him, this was a new invention. A real event told with all the eloquence, pacing, style, and verve that rarely sparkles this bright if not imagined. Tellingly, journalist Amy Wilson, who spearheaded this episode, bought a fresh copy for her research. Barnes & Noble shelves it under fiction. The truth of it was discussed earliest, probably, by the people of Holcomb. Ray Shearmeyer, a juror in the Smith-Hickok trial.
Anything like that, there's got to be so much fiction written into the book, you know. At least if it wasn't fiction, there was a lot of it I didn't remember. That was only a few years afterwards, you know.
Neighbor Wilma Kidwell was more generous. She said that a lot of people in town didn't even read the book, but she did.
I thought it was true. People here resented it. They resented the fact that he made money from their tragedy. Is the way I feel about it. I don't know. I think they did. I didn't. I thought he was just reporting.
Esquire magazine, just a month after the book rolled off the presses, sent a reporter to Kansas to settle the debate and find out what was true and what wasn't.
I can't tell you how often I hear, oh, I'm a little OCD. I like things neat. That's not OCD. I'm Howie Mandel, and I know this because I have OCD. Actual OCD causes relentless, unwanted thoughts. What if I did something terrible and forgot? What if I'm a bad person? Why am I thinking this terrible thing? It makes you question absolutely everything, and you'll do anything to feel better. OCD is debilitating, but it's also highly treatable with the right kind of therapy. Regular talk therapy doesn't cut it. OCD needs specialized therapy. That's why I want to tell you about NoCD. NoCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for OCD. Their licensed therapists provide specialized therapy virtually, and it's covered by insurance for over 155 million Americans. If you think you might be struggling with OCD, visit NoCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call and learn more. That's NoCD.com.
Esquire reporter Philip K. Tompkins descended on Holcomb, Kansas in 1966, just after the town was thrust into the international spotlight thanks to Truman Capote's groundbreaking book, In Cold Blood. Tompkins worked to tease out fact from fiction in a piece that ran June 1, 1966, titled In Cold Truth. He indeed found that a list of less than completely true tidbits had been published in Capote's book, despite Capote's repeated insistence that he didn't fudge a single detail. Most specifically, Tompkins found that Capote had fabricated a few conversations that Perry Smith was supposed to have had with the Garden City Undersheriff's wife, things that made Smith look more naive and fragile than he probably was. Capote was gay, and many have assumed he was enamored with Smith, explaining the soft peddling of Smith's homicidal personality in the book. Marie Dewey, the widow of the KBI agent Alvin Dewey, saw it differently.
Truman associated his feelings with Perry Smith in that he had a sad childhood. That shouldn't have influenced a person's life. And you follow a certain path, and then there's a fork in the road. And Perry Smith chose to take a wrong turn. But Truman took the right turn there and becoming the writer.
Still, many knew he had stretched his literary license way too far. Capote put Dewey at the center of the investigation, even though three other agents did most of the work, with Dewey mainly acting as a press liaison and a clearinghouse for tips and reports from the field. Dewey made good copy, though, and his upgrade to the Sherlock Holmes of the American Plains hardly tore at the fabric of the original story. That is, until years later, it was revealed that Ron Nye, the son of the crime's primary KBI investigator, Harold Nye, had been handed his father's notes a while back when his mother was cleaning out the attic as she readied to move from the family home. Ron Nye forgot about the notes in his possession until 2012, when he was trying to figure out how to pay for a loved one's long-term care. This is where Greg McAvoy, an unassuming vintage memorabilia dealer in Seattle, was contacted and said sure, he'd sell what Ron Nye had, though it was not his usual fare. The elder Nye had kept everything from his years as an investigator. His wife had shredded most of it, but the box marked clutter had escaped the shredder. It was filled to the brim with steno pads and random letters and this and that. McAvoy spent a little time organizing it and then offered it up for sale, issuing a press release about its availability in hopes of drumming up interest. Just before the auction, the state of Kansas moved in to halt the proceedings. They said it was their property. Nye and McAvoy argued that that ship had sailed long ago when Capote stepped in to use most of whatever that investigation generated. Kansas wasn't mollified, choosing instead to fight tooth and nail in court to keep the paper secret. I'm a journalist, and if you know me, you know what my next question is going to be. What were they afraid of? Come to find out, McAvoy had a friend, an investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal, who asked the same thing and told McAvoy that there was most certainly something in those boxes they didn't want to see the light of day. Here's a snippet of McAvoy talking on the most notorious podcast about the lawsuit the KBI had filed.
We decided to take the case on, defending ourselves on First Amendment issues, because we believe the materials contained items of public interest. After 4 years in court, the judge ruled in our favor, even fining the Kansas Attorney General some $4,000 for false allegations that cost us a great deal to defend against. So in the end, we were able to do what we wanted with Harold Nye's archive.
The cease and desist turned out to be a dumb idea on the part of the state. McAvoy even noted that all they really had to do was buy it at the initial auction, and they'd have been home free. But no, Kansas sent in the big guns and challenged Ron Nye's right to even own the notes. Which is funny, really, because in another interview, McAvoy made clear that he hadn't really cared what was in the notes. He just wanted to help sell them.
I had little interest in the minutiae of all the reports, the investigative documents. The crime scene photos were just grisly and very difficult to look at. I just wanted to mount a simple auction.
The auction delay gave McAvoy a perfect chance to really look at the papers and see if something fresh and objectionable was indeed lurking somewhere in them. Then McAvoy, because fate is funny, got offered a second collection in relation to the crime. They were Dick Hickok's letters to a journalist who had wanted to write what he called the real history of the case. Mac Nations, a reporter for the Wichita Eagle, had corresponded with Hickok, asking pertinent questions as he went and collecting all the letters so he could write that book. It was going to be named High Road to Hell. Sadly, Nations died in a single car crash when his car hit an embankment in rural Colorado on Christmas Eve 1968 before the book was even sent out to an agent to be shopped around to a publisher. The only manuscript disappeared that night, according to McAvoy. Cue the eerie music. But the Hickok letters remained. Those letters, when combined with the Nye notes, set off a chain reaction that began to eat away at the Capote narrative of the Clutter killings. And one of the crimes of the 20th century began to look a little less clean, a tad more intriguing, and, while not completely full of holes, hole-filled enough to make you wonder why the boat wasn't leaking. What's new? Let's start with Harold Nye's stash of stuff. It's not really my style, but I think, for clarity's sake, I'm going to list what Nye wrote at the time of the investigation that somehow never became part of the story as we all know it. 1. There's evidence that in the last few days before his murder, Herb Clutter had been nervous, even having taken up smoking, something he was known to abhor. That's especially interesting when you add in the tidbit about him getting his life insurance policy after years of ignoring it. 2. There's evidence that Herb had been having an ongoing affair with Mildred Lyon, the wife of Ken Lyon, a close friend. 3. There's evidence that another good friend of Alvin Dewey knew of the affair and had reports of same in his possession during the investigation. Also, that Dewey was a friend of Herb's and he may have chosen to protect the dead man's reputation. 4. There had been talk around town that the Clutters were nearly broke. That was ridiculous. Herb didn't carry cash, but he was worth about $2 million in 1959. Which is more than $20 million in today's money. His wealth was in land and cattle and wheat, but it had real value. 5. Nobody at the KBI, especially Alvin Dewey, believed cellmate Floyd Wells' story, particularly in the beginning. It took them 5 days to even get around to talking to him after he made the claim that he'd told Hickok everything he had to do to make a big score at the Clutter House. 6. In fact, upon checking Wells' work record, they found he did work for the Clutters for a few weeks, but was likely fired by Herb Clutter for drinking. He was not employed anywhere near Holcomb when the Clutters were actually building their house. He had never been in the house. He could never have seen the safe, even if it had existed, which, of course, it hadn't. So who gave Perry and Hickok a working map? 7. Between 2 and 3 a.m. on the morning of the crime, before anyone knew the Clutters were dead, three men, two fitting the description of Smith and Hickok, were seen by the town marshal having breakfast at the Western Cafe in Cimarron, Kansas, a 45-minute drive from Holcomb. There's a document that records the sighting before Smith and Hickok had been arrested. 8. Hickok was known to have arrived back at his parents' home in Olathe, Kansas at noon, the day of the killings. Accounting for the time for the murders and the drive back to Olathe, 90 minutes were unaccounted for. Maybe they were having breakfast in Cimarron with someone. 9. On November 11th, before the crime occurred, three men were seen in a vehicle matching the description of Perry and Hickok in their car. They were a half mile from the Clutter home, and finally, 10. Despite the fact that Herb and Bonnie did not sleep in the same room and had not had sex in years, there was semen left on the back of the dressing gown she wore that night. All this was known during the investigation, but never mentioned in Capote's quote-unquote immaculately factual book. It's a hard pill to swallow that trained investigators decided to accept some evidence and disregard other evidence. It's just not something that should ever happen, especially in these murders, ones that had so terrorized that town and so seemed to upset the very notion that people in the heartland were safer than people in the cities. Especially when people in Holcomb had never mistrusted their neighbors and the motives of those around them. Hell, they had never even locked their doors at night. They did now. All because Dick Hickok and Perry Smith came knocking. So now we're left with this. Either somebody wanted Herb Clutter dead in a semi-spectacular fashion, or these two small-time, short-tempered thieves acting on a story they heard from a random cellmate serving time for a misdemeanor drove a pretty far piece to invade a home, molest its residents, take whatever cash they could find, and kill everyone in sight. Then drive to a pre-assigned location to meet with another man in the middle of the night. The hitch here, or one of them, it seems, is the map that Floyd Wells could not have drawn.
Floyd Wells is the single most mysterious character in this entire story. He worked for Herb Clutter in late 1948 for about 7 months as a farmhand. There wasn't much thrust given to Wells when, in fact, he was really the one who started it all. Capote only dedicated two paragraphs to Wells in In Cold Blood.
Which brings us to the letters Dick Hickok shared with Mac Nations that veer a bit from what Capote wrote. Oh, and an aside here, the KBI still maintains that Capote's version is the true version. They even commemorate the solving of the crime and the subsequent notoriety they received for their fine work at their headquarters. But back to Hickok and Nations. The two began their correspondence in 1961 with a promise by Hickok that he would be truthful. He wrote, quote, "I explained to you before that I would tell you the facts regardless of what they were," end quote. He added he would stick to that promise even if those facts made him look worse. Now, please remember, Hickok was a notorious liar, so take that as you may. In one of the first letters, Hickok unknowingly confirmed what the Cimarron sheriff had told the KBI and the post-killing meet and greet. He even named the guy. I quote from the letter, which is reprinted in McAvoy's book, and every word is true. Quote, "While the family was in the bathroom, we continued our search of the house. I looked upstairs, my partner down. We took a portable radio out of the boys' room upstairs and we put it in the car. We were running short of time and didn't look the house over or tear it up like we should. It was almost 2 o'clock and our meeting with Roberts was about an hour away. We didn't want to miss that. $5,000 is a lot of dough," end quote. In another letter, detailing his thoughts as he was about to enter the Clutter home, he wrote, quote, "I don't know why, it is hard to explain, but I felt a measure of mixed emotions. I felt excitement, a thrill. I was going to kill a person, maybe more than one. Could I do it? Maybe I'll back out. What if they are not home? I hope they're not. But I can't back out. I've taken the money. I've spent most of it. Besides, I thought I know too much," end quote. Then this, as he continued to recount that night, quote, "just like the diagram Roberts had given me showed," end quote. In a later letter, he wrote, quote, "besides, we had to make it look like a robbery," end quote. In another letter, he reiterated that point, quote, "I left the wallet lying on the bed. I wanted it to be found empty. My partner found a couple other articles that were likely to be missed, and these he took to the car," end quote. Lastly, at least for our purposes, he wrote of his desire for the world to know he was capable of this kind of achievement. Quote, "But wait till they find these people, then they will know, and I'm getting paid for it too," end quote. Immediately following the deaths, plenty of the Clutter's neighbors thought there was some other something going on here besides a robbery. Herb's brother voiced this, saying the reason for the killing lay within 10 miles of the crime. Capote briefly entertained the notion that Floyd Wells had been involved in it. Even KBI's Dewey originally figured robbery was not the motive. There were leads here, good ones. Leads that investigators could have and should have gone down. But nobody had time for that. The time that elapsed between the capture of Smith and Hickok and the day they were sentenced to be hanged was less than 3 months. Their death date had been set for just 6 weeks later. That, of course, was delayed for 5 years because of the appeals process. But even with that, the whole thing has a mighty short timeline, even if law enforcement had the men's confessions in hand. Still, Perry Smith and Dick Hickok sat in prison and never once tried to finger the person who might have ordered the hit, if there was one. They were facing the death penalty. That's mighty strong incentive to, at the very least, buy some time with a new story. But they didn't. Maybe Smith was always in the dark, just going along with what Hickok said, or maybe Hickok feared his family would be in danger if he spoke up. Maybe I've been immersed so long in true crime that I see conspiracies where there are none. Still, it's also possible the KBI told Capote what they wanted the story to be. Not explicitly, but by only handing him certain data and documents so they could tie this one up with a bow. Harold Nye was rewarded for his work on the Clutter case by being made assistant director of the KBI only months after the case was solved. He went on to become its director in 1969, unwillingly having to become political to keep his job, something he really wasn't happy doing. When a few years later he crossed the Kansas Attorney General, he was demoted and things went south from there. Let's just say he died a bitter man. But he was not a disloyal one. He did not openly reveal what he may have known or suspected or feared, either. Ezra Benson, the agriculture secretary who really despised all that Herb Clutter stood for, went on to become the head of the Mormon Church. Ken Lyon, the husband of the woman who might have had an affair with Herb, ended up handling the family's estate as its administrative trustee, according to McAvoy's book. After his testimony in the trial, Floyd Wells was sent to a halfway house only 2 months later, 2 years before his earliest parole date. Scheduled to be there for 10 months, he was released after 5 weeks. Plea agreement, anyone? In time, the town of Holcomb got larger. The Clutter House used to be a morbid little tourist attraction, but is now a private home again. Interestingly, Capote helped to end death by hanging in this country. His description of it in the book, and the fact that it took Perry Smith 20 minutes to die after his footing gave way, was far too graphic, too cruel and unusual to continue. After his death in 1984, Truman Capote's papers were given to the New York Public Library, including everything he had kept from the years writing In Cold Blood. McAvoy and Ron Nye also placed Harold Nye's box of notebooks there. Curiously, in 1987, after Alvin Dewey's death, his wife Marie went to the customary Christmas party at KBI headquarters. In tears, she offered apologies to all there, saying she was, quote, "very sorry for what Alvin and she had done and asked for their forgiveness," end quote. What had they done? They had befriended Truman Capote and Harper Lee. Alvin had given them total access to everything so that he could write the book. They had hobnobbed, they had been starstruck. But had they been more than imprudent? Had they been guilty of a cover-up? Had they lied? The moral of this story, I guess, is it's not over till it's over. And this one doesn't feel over. Journalist Amy Wilson reread In Cold Blood and read Gary McAvoy's And Every Word Is True. She rewatched Capote, the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman. There are all kinds of podcasts, mini-docs, and weird little things on the internet that dredge up the clutters and the book for analysis. She watched quite a few, including In Cold Blood Revisited, Richard Uhling, 2018, which had great archival footage included. I also want to send a nod to the most notorious podcast. If you like this one, you should check out theirs. It's more interview-based and worth a listen. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.